From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a school in New York City, the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The 10th grade students there are, like many 10th graders, addicted to technology. And if they're reading books, they're probably reading just to get ready for an upcoming test. Journalist and author David Denby is someone who has loved great literature his entire life, and he wanted to know, can you take a 15-year-old student who doesn't read much beyond text messages and turn them into a lover of classic literature, or at least someone who knows how to read it, how to understand it? And if the answer is yes, then how? Well, Denby spent time observing a remarkable teacher named Sean Leon at the Beacon School in New York. He found a teacher who challenged students and who believed to his core that great books matter. Denby's new book is called Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. A colleague of mine recommended it, and I have to say that in some ways it gave me hope for both the teaching profession and for students. It also made me a little concerned that what Denby was experiencing was more outlier than typical, but let's talk about that. How do you get students engaged in great literature, and why does it matter? My guest is author David Denby. Thank you for joining the program, sir.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I just want to back up to where this idea came from for you, and I think maybe it's worth reminding our listeners your previous book around a generation ago, because I think great literature is something that this program, we touch on it quite often. We talk to teachers, we talk to students about how to get people engaged. This book is all about that. So how did this come to be, David?
Well, I did do this earlier book. I was film critic at New York Magazine. I was a film critic for 45 years, until recently, actually. But I did do this earlier book called Great Books, which was I did during the curriculum debate of the late 80s, early 90s. We're in a multicultural society. Should we be asking children of African or Latin descent to be reading the Western classics? So the way to answer that question, I thought, would be to go back to my alma mater, Columbia, which requires all students, incoming students, to take these two courses, one in literature, one in political theory and philosophy. And I took them, so to speak, I took them again. I was then 48. And I wrote it up as a kind of placid middle-aged adventure. I read all the books. I didn't take part in conversations. I kept my mouth shut, which is not easy for me, and sat in the side of the room and listened to some very good teachers and some good, great, and not so great students. So that was the background. And this particular book, the new one, Lit Up, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was sitting around with my wife, Susan Rieger, and trying to figure out what in the world are kids reading these days. I mean, what is their private personal reading? How much of it is there? And the surveys on this by Pew and other people are not encouraging. And second, reading in school? Does anyone still read Catcher in the Rye or Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter? Or Hemingway, or whatever. I didn't know the answer, and we were just sitting around making lists of books and everything. And around that time, a guy came up to me on the street, on my street on the Upper West Side, and started talking to me about a school where he had taught for years, and that's the school you mentioned in your intro, Beacon School, was then on the Upper West Side behind Lincoln Center. So I thought, well, here's a way of sort of recapitulating what I did in the earlier book, and a strategy, a way into this question: what matters to kids in their reading? How do you turn them on, as you said, to reading good things? Well, I would try to repeat the strategy of the earlier book, which is to enter a class, and that's what I did. And I spent an entire year in Sean Leon's class, 10th grade English in Beacon. And then I went on in the subsequent years to go up to New Haven to an inner city school, and also to Mamaroneck, New York, upper middle class suburb up the coast of the Long Island Sound. And so I melded the three experiences into this text.
The book, I got to say, David, I mean, I don't want to overstate things, but I think it's not only a fascinating read. I think it's important. I've already talked to high school English teachers who are friends, and they're quickly ordering the book and thinking about some
well,
of the
thanks.
Themes already.
And, you don't want to do publicity on the side, do you, maybe?
Well, no.
As a consultant or something?
Hey, well, look, we do 500 hours a year, but it's amazing how fast that time gets eaten up. And we do
really?
Some books, but not too many. And I think this is truly an important book. And for our listeners in the audience this hour, I want to hear from you eventually on this as we kind of go throughout this discussion. I want to ask a couple of questions of our listening audience. Number one, if you've got kids, do they read for pleasure? If they do, what do they think of, I guess, what we would call the classics or great literature? Do they find them drudgery? Do they read them for the test in school? Or will they pick them up, do you think, later in life? Do you think your kids, listeners, have been impacted by great teaching? And how much of a kid wanting to read is a teacher reaching them in dynamic ways? Call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And for the Tims and Pitchfords of the world who want to get cynical about millennials, you want to call and complain that they only read text messages, I guess you can do that. But we're going to try to be somewhat hopeful, because David Denby's given me at least a little bit of hope with this book. And so I'm going to start with where you started, which is going into Sean Leon's class. It's the start of the school year.
Right.
And I even thought the way he reached out to these sophomores and got their attention, he knew their names coming in the door. And these were the little things he was doing. If you could, for our audience, set the scene that you witnessed when he was kind of greeting these students.
I don't know how he knew their names coming in the door. Their pictures were probably on the school website, and that's the only thing. I never asked him. That's the only thing I can think of. And he immediately established a kind of wonderfully wrapped atmosphere of attention to each other. And he said that they had to look at the person they were talking to. They had to address them by name. He was a little bit intimidating, but friendly at the same time. And this, of course, is the secret of great teaching, is to be strong, directed, a little bit overbearing, a little bit joking, but also friendly, encouraging at the same time. And he was then about 39. He's of Irish descent. He grew up in Louisiana. No traceable accent. I couldn't figure out where he was from till he told me. But he has a very clear and powerful voice and a way of seeming to address every person individually in the room. And this is another secret of great teaching. I couldn't do this. I can write. I can observe. I can write. I could not keep the attention level of 32 people for a prolonged period, and also knowing how much each of them is plugged into what I'm saying. That I notice this with other teachers too. They seem to have antennae going out to everyone in the room. Now, even if it's noisy sometimes and disorderly, they know where the students are. I couldn't do that. Maybe you could do that. I couldn't do that. So that was what he did, and he told them that he was going to challenge them, and that literature was of enormous importance to them in the most direct way in determining who they were. What kind of person were they going to be? Were they going to be, two dimensions or three dimensions? Were they going to be reflective? Were they going to know themselves? Were they going to know their society? Were they going to understand other people? Many large issues that he then worked out throughout the year.
He told them that he was not essentially, I'm trying to remember here, but I think the message was that their opinions, or at least their views, as long as they're reading and hanging with it, it matters. That
right.
there's going to be different interpretations. They will debate it. They'll fight certain things out. Now, once in a while, he moves them back on course. And we'll get into some of my favorite little sort of odd moments where things kind of went, which was a fascinating look at how 15 and 16-year-olds are seeing the world in 2010, 2011, 2012. But he really did let them know early on, you're not just going to be here reading for a test, and then you move on and you don't care. He essentially told them, didn't he, David, I care about what you think.
Yes, and just on the test issue, Beacon is one of the progressive schools in New York. There are a lot of them, in which testing is not terribly important. It's a writing. The test is sort of what you can write, what you can speak in class, and what you can present at the end of the course in a kind of direct confrontation with your teacher. This is true in the humanities, not in the sciences. In history, and English. And they don't much believe. I mean, they take the Regents tests and, you know, certain standard tests like that, and there were quizzes all through the year. I mean, obviously you wanted to be sure they were reading. They were very closely monitored. For instance, they kept a classroom notebook, and he insisted they take down what was going on, what other people said, and that they hand in those notebooks every once in a while. This makes for a lot of extra work for a teacher. They were given out the books, as in most public schools. These are all public schools, by the way. Let's be clear about that I'm talking about. And they would attach, Post-its, these, you know, multicolored little things, notes to their text when they had something comment to make. I mean, the books were so heavily festooned with pink and yellow and blue Post-its, they looked like tropical birds that couldn't get off the ground. But then he would, when we were done with that book and it was time for them to hand it back, he would collect the Post-its from each student and read those also. So, I mean, this is a phenomenal amount. So on the one hand, we don't have big formal tests, a lot of little quizzes to be sure they're doing their reading. On the other hand, they're very closely monitored, both in their reading and in the classroom. And, had them stand up and make presentations and engage each other. It was a very active class, and if things were getting stale, he would break up the format, even rearrange the desks. Reshuffle the way the kids were sitting, give them sort of fun and interesting exercises to do. And then the thing about his reading list that surprised me was that it wasn't a standard reading list. They didn't read Shakespeare. They didn't read Mark Twain. They didn't read Toni Morrison. I mean, what you would expect in a good 10th grade English class. They read, I guess, what you'd have to call existential texts. They read stories by Hawthorne and Faulkner. They read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. They read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. They read books they read Sylvia Plath's poetry, late poems, fiercely challenging late poems. They read things that raise the question of, you know, the most direct questions: how are you going to live your life? What is your relation to society? What are you as an individual? What's your connection to this larger entity and to other people? Now, those are conversations that at this stage in our lives, you and I might be embarrassed to have, but you're not embarrassed certainly when you're 15. That's the time when kids are asking. They may not be consciously asking them, but they're certainly, that's a period of, you know, identity shifting. Who am I? Am I straight? Am I gay? Do I want to go to college? Do I want to go into the military? What kind of work do I want to do, like that. And so he would engage that adolescent desire to fix an identity, to tell one's own story, by turning it towards the books and then coming back towards them. And there were classes that were in which they would hold forth on their individual nature and problems. I don't mean that it degenerated into group therapy, or Sunday afternoon in the church basement. It always came back to the books. It had to. That was the point. But he would use the books to open up those basic questions.
Sure. And a couple of things I'll just let our listeners know. I mean, there's three schools profiled. And just the nature of this talk show and what always happens to me, I make a bunch of notes. I probably won't get past Sean Leon, but he's not the only one, is what I'm saying. And so, listeners, when you pick up Lit Up by David Denby, you're going to get a sense for Sean Leon and his remarkably dynamic approach that we're talking about right now. You're also going to, kind of move around a little bit here. It's not just about what you would think of as more privileged. I mean, it's three different schools. So, but we're focusing on Sean for now. And I did want to kind of hit one point, because David just brought up the fact that he had a little bit more freedom or a chance to create a reading list that he thought was suitable for these 15-year-olds at this moment in their lives, that they might be able to connect in certain ways. And here's why I said it off the top, David, that I'm a little concerned that this is more of an outlier. Because Sean eventually tells you himself that he thinks about going to teach in another state, that he thinks about changing things up. But then he keeps going back to the fact that everywhere else you go, it's test, 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 right. Test, test. And here's the reading list. here's the expected structure. Here's how you have to do it. I'm not saying he had no rules, but when he viewed what he was doing at Beacon compared to what his opportunities were elsewhere, he did not find it compelling. And my concern is, damn, is this not doable in many other places?
Well, I mean, there are good schools, good public schools all over the place. And there are good students all over the place. Beacon is not at the very top rung of New York schools. It's sort of the upper middle rung. You have to score in the upper half, not the upper quarter, of the math and English tests that all New York students take in seventh grade, and then of course you're entering high school in ninth grade. And you have to be able to do something. You have to be able to create a science experiment or design a website or write a little bit or dance or take a picture. So these are not typical students. But one of my problems in conceiving the book was, what is a typical American high school? You know, I don't think you could find one that would typify all of the elements in this incredibly complicated society. So I thought, all right, find a school where teaching literature seems to work. And I scouted, beforehand. I went to other schools. I went to other classes besides John Leon's. I said, see what we can learn from something that works. And to answer your question, is this possible elsewhere? Sure it is. No one is going to be Sean Leon, but they could take parts of what he does, parts of his method, parts of his reading list. We concluded, by the way, with Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, which is a short novel at the beginning of his great period, just before Crime and Punishment, an extremely daunting text, and the kids loved it. They rose to it. The hero is this embittered, socially withdrawn intellectual who screws himself up at every opportunity. One of the great sort of aggressive masochist heroes in all literature. And they took turns playing him in a kind of classroom exercise and questioning him. He got them involved in those issues, which were also issues that were real for them. And I don't see why that can't be done at other schools, maybe not with Notes from Underground, which is a difficult book for anyone to read at any time. I've read it four times, and I don't begin to think I've understood all of it. But, you could find other texts, and you could find students who would rise to this kind of challenge. Because I'll tell you, I didn't see anyone, they were a little bit nervous, but I didn't see anyone dropping out, so to speak, spiritually. They were flattered by the difficulty of the books and the nature. I mean, some of these things were rather bleak. Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut's book about Billy Pilgrim, his sort of weak hero gets caught up in the Dresden bombing in World War II, and then becomes a dentist in upstate New York. That was black comedy, a lot of it, and that they actually had more trouble with that than they had with the Dostoevsky, because when you're 15, you don't know what you have the permission to laugh at. Right? I mean, there's a lot of spoofing, obviously, all through the media, and a lot of play and a lot of satire and jokes, but this was about death. How do you laugh at death? How do you find it both grotesque and absurd? That was a challenge that they're just, you could say, they were too young for that book. But many of the others, there were the journey books like Siddhartha, about it, set in ancient India, about a young man who encounters the Buddha and then tries to figure out who he is in relation to religion and God and everything. That was an enormous hit when I was a kid, in the '60s. That if you were in Berkeley or in New York or anywhere, probably you saw kids carrying that one in their back pocket. So he's reviving that one. Because it's also about those questions of how am I going to live my life? What are my obligations to other people? I mean, you see what's at stake here. We're not just talking about, are we going to have readers for good books in the future? We're talking about what kind of civilization are we going to have in the United States? Are we going to have a reasonably reflective, thoughtful society? I'll put it politically. If everyone had read Huckleberry Finn, they would know what a con artist is. Here we have this guy running for president who doesn't make any sense at all and who's just fueling people's anxieties. They would know what a con artist is because of those two con artists in Huckleberry Finn if they had all read it. So, it's about the future of this reading issue is not, it's about the future of what, of the culture and of American civilization.
Bill in Brighton, I'm coming to you on the phone in just a second, but just to follow up on that point, I think what I saw with Sean Leon, and I hope we can get to some of the things I really want to talk about, because listeners, if you think, well, how do you relate this stuff to their lives? Just wait till you hear about the social media blackout that he used with, was it Brave New World? So we'll get there, and the way he connected. Right. Just, I thought was just brilliant as an example. But again, this was a teacher who's much more concerned with process and discussion over the test. The quizzes and the tests matter, but they are not the be-all, end-all, and the students know it. Not only do the students know it, they're told you are going to participate. And, you know, it should be interesting. It occasionally should be fun, but it's a process. It's a discussion. It's not about what was your score on the test on Brave New World. And I hope if that can travel, that it does travel, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, let me grab Bill in Brighton, first up on the phone. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, David. I wanted to inquire of you whether there's an analogy to early reading. My son, when my grandson was first born, he was reading to him within several years with expression. And, of course, when they as they grow, they memorize those words. Those words, they memorize them.
Yeah.
They don't understand what they are on the page. And then at age five, that exciting moment when they are putting together letters and words to go with those memorized sounds, read with expression. And what has happened is this ceremony of reading, which is so inculcated into my grandson's daily life, is that if he is rewarded with really doing a great job, Dan will take him to the library to look at other things other than children's books to stimulate his imagination. And this is what's interesting. That's the positive end. His punishment, if he hasn't obeyed some sensible family rules of empathy and compassion, the punishment is taking away his books. He will go hysterical. He will do anything not to have his books taken away from him. Isn't that a wonderful, exciting
Well, I think that this is a kid in which the battle has already been won.
Can you do that?
Because reading is extremely important to him. His parents must have read to him a lot when he was an infant. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, the kid is maybe 6 weeks old. You sit him or her down between you and your mate, and you start reading. Of course, you're not going to remember anything, and you start turning pages in a picture book. But they're going to have some sort of, I don't know what the proper psychological term is, some sort of affective memory of having been held and read to and associating that with pleasure. Because this is the problem now. There are so many media distractions for teenagers that the association with pleasure, which of course is what drives us to do anything, right, except what we have to do to earn and eat and live. But pleasure is the pleasure principle, as Freud said, is what drives so much of our behavior. That gets lost. I mean, it sounds like your grandson has it, which is fantastic. And I imagine he'll always have it. So if the link is created early, that's the best possible way of making people into lifetime readers.
The book is called Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives by journalist and author David Denby, who is my guest for the hour. And just as I suspected, the hour is flying. Let's get our only break in, and we're going to come back and talk more about this remarkable teacher, these remarkable teachers featured in the book, and some of the approaches that help students who are 15, 16. Again, think about how cynical you might feel. And I did get an email, of course, from Tim in Pittsford who said he's listening. Think about how cynical you may feel about 15 and 16-year-olds. They only read text messages. They're on social media all the time. And the books are anathema to them. Well, we're going to find out how a teacher even used that idea and connected it to a book, and also how this teacher allowed them to occasionally mix it up and occasionally be wrong, even in very weird ways, before steering it back on some of the big themes of the book. I just loved reading this book. I think you will too. So we continue with David Denby in just a moment on Connections. And Let me tell you about what's coming up tomorrow on Connections. Actor Richard Dreyfuss joins us. He's the guest speaker at East House's 2016 Hope and Recovery Luncheon. That's a fundraiser to support East House program and services. They help people with mental illness and substance abuse disorders. Richard Dreyfuss on the program tomorrow. Then second hour, we're talking drought, extreme drought in upstate. What does it mean for harvest across the board? It's different in different places. We're going to get the real sense of that tomorrow. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Journalist and author David Denby is my guest, who's on the line with us. And I'm scrambling through my notes here, David. Which was the Hawthorne story where they got really weird in class before he kind of steered him back?
Oh, the minister's black veil.
Can you tell us about
that? One of Hawthorne's greatest and most mysterious stories. I recommend it to everybody, although don't expect to understand it at the first shot. I mean, it's about a minister in old New England who shows up for service one day with his face covered with a veil and offers no explanation and never takes the veil off. And everyone is baffled, amazed, puzzled. He sort of wanders around the town like a specter, destroying people's pleasure. And they don't know what to make of it. And it's a fable of Puritanism. It's a kind of accusation. You think that you're pure, but actually you are veiled. And they thought that he, because they're obsessed with the individual and the society, the 15-year-olds thought, well, he's a rebel against society. No, that's not what it's about. It's about how in Puritan, theology, you're inherently guilty, and you always are unless you constantly purify yourself in some way, and which is a very difficult thing for young people to understand, that such a mentality ever existed at all. Original sin, the sin that you can't break free of. The veil is a kind of accusation against the town. Well, I mean, so they, Mr. Leon didn't, when they were obviously going on the wrong way, he played them off against each other. He sounded out their opinions, and he sort of gently carried it back to a more sensible interpretation. But the point is, you don't say, oh, that's wrong, that's crazy. You play with it, because it's their opinion, and then you get them to examine it. You get them to play off each other. As I said, it was a very good text. That was right at the beginning, almost at the beginning of the year.
And throughout the year, they seemed to. It was interesting to hear how teenagers today view sexuality, sort of permissiveness, and they occasionally, I think, it seemed to struggle with the text because they're coming in with their frame of reference in the world today, not necessarily when these books were written.
Yes, I wandered into an 11th grade class just to, because they were reading The Scarlet Letter, and The Scarlet Letter is about another Puritan period thing, 1635 in old Boston, and a married woman whose husband is away, Hester Prynne, has an adulterous affair with a handsome young minister, and she conceives a child, and she's made to wear a scarlet letter, right? Basic, great American novel. And the 11th graders, some of them, couldn't see what the fuss was about. She's married and she has a child. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
And they didn't see how, it involves very serious choices when you're in a small society where everyone knows everyone else, and you commit adultery and what the consequences of it are. But they came to that. And that teacher had, since Hawthorne's language is stilted because he wrote it in the 1840s and he said it 200 years earlier, and it's formal in ways that seem very odd to them. The teacher broke up the text into a series of scripts and handed them out, and different students played different characters, including the narrator, and then they switched around. So as they spoke the words, they got into the emotions of the language because they had to act them out. I don't mean that it was a kind of great acting or anything, but the oddest, most wonderful thing happened is if they would read a certain character, after a while, they would sort of, so to speak, grow into that character, become that character by the exercise of reading it aloud in class. I'm sure many teachers do this, and I'm sure it works sometimes and doesn't work other times. It depends, I think, how self-confident the kids are. that also that they can allow to themselves to lose themselves in a part. But again, this is not therapy. This is literature. But it certainly involves bringing the kid's own temperament into the study of literature.
Let me get back to the phones. David in Aurora, listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio. You're on with David Denby. Go ahead, David.
Hi. Yes, I had a great English teacher in 10th grade and probably one of the best teachers I've ever had, along with a good physics teacher and a good composition teacher. But the thing I wanted to mention was Vonnegut's book, the film is actually better than the book. And Vonnegut himself said that. I've read both. I've read the book, and I've seen the film several times, and the film is definitely better than the book.
Just is it George Roy Hill? Is that the director? I'm trying to remember. Does that sound right? Anyway, go ahead. It's not important. Go ahead.
And the other thing, the other thing is that he was an optometrist, not a dentist.
Not okay, you're absolutely right, and eyes are very important to the whole thing. Good correction.
Well, it's not very important, but it's just somewhat, you know, just something to say. But I don't know if you've seen the film, and this is unusual probably, that the film would be better than the book, but the film definitely expands what the book has to say, and I think in that case it's good.
Yeah, I remember it was quite a while ago, but I've read the book now three times, and I have to say it, I think it's very powerful. It's a very strange book in many ways, but it really gets to me. And as I was saying earlier, the kids had trouble with that one in a way they didn't with even more difficult texts like Dostoevsky, because it's Vonnegut is sort of a black comedian. You know, the absurdity of death in the most extraordinary ways. People keep dying in that novel and in the film. That was rough for them. That was an element of perversity in fate that is something that when you're 15 you're not ready to hear. But I'm glad they heard it.
As a brief aside, David, given the work that you've done on film and writing, I just want to ask you, I recall when the first Harry Potter film was coming out and The Onion had a headline that said, "New Harry Potter film opens kids up to the magic of not reading." And
exactly.
I enjoyed that.
Well, they have read Harry Potter, most of them, certainly at a place like Beacon. And a lot have read things like The Hunger Games and other dystopian stuff. They love fantasy, obviously, and they love teenagers are often also drawn to horror. That they have a feeling for not just the fantastic, but for apocalypse. Of one kind or another, and in Mr. Leon's class, they read the two dystopian classics of the 20th century, Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984. And we had the usual lively debate about one is a tyranny ruled by pleasure, that's Brave New World, and the other is a tyranny ruled by pain and fear, that's 1984. So we had that kind of discussion. I was, which I think I had in high school 50 years earlier.
Well, Craig and Brighton wants to jump in on Brave New World. I would just say, David kind of surveyed the students at one point in the year to kind of get a sense for what they read, if they're reading on their own. And you kind of came to the conclusion that, what, there were 3 out of 32 were actual readers coming into
were serious readers, although I would say, in all fairness, that number increased by the end of the year.
Right, but the point is
early.
The deck...
Tell that little story about the digital fast?
Absolutely. The deck, though, was not stacked. You know, this wasn't one of those schools where, oh, come on, this is all the best of the best, and or these kids came in already reading Dostoevsky. I mean, this is not that case at all.
As I said, it's in the upper, I would say the upper middle rung of New York public schools. It's ethnically mixed. It's mixed in terms, I should have made that clear. It's mixed in terms of family income. About a quarter of the students get free lunch, which means that their families fall below the poverty line, according to national levels. So it's a mixed group. I mean, it's a good group. It's a good lively group. Anyway, what Mr. Leon said was, how many hours a week do you guys... are you on digital media? He totaled up his own totals, and I secretly totaled up mine. And so many hours on computers, so many hours watching television, so many hours on our smartphones, and so on and so forth. And to my astonishment, some of them, when he asked them their totals, had more hours than there were hours in the week.
There's 168 hours in the week, and several students were over 200 hours on digital media. What was their explanation for how they pulled that off?
He and I looked at each other like, what are we missing here? And they laughed at our bafflement and said, you know, multitasking. I do my homework with the television on. In fact, I can't do my homework without the television being on. And, you know, a lot of people said that, and my heart sank because there are so many studies that show if you're multitasking, you're not getting much of what you're doing in either place. If you're, you know, maybe reading and music that you absorb the reading, but there's a lot of studies on this. If, you know, you're not concentrating on one thing, you're not getting much of anything. But that, yeah, they constantly had Facebook on one side of their computer screen, say, while they were doing their homework, that kind of thing. So he said to them, all right, how are you going to spend your life? Really, what are you going to do with your life? I mean, how many hours are you going to spend sleeping? I mean, I couldn't believe he was saying this. How many hours are you going to spend working? What are you going to do with the, you know, and we totaled up if they lived to 80. And then he said, all right, I want you to fast on all digital connections for 48 hours. Don't do it. Now, if you have to go on the computer to do your homework, okay. But otherwise, no television, no telephone, no cell phone, no iPad, no iPod, nothing. They weren't graded or anything like that. It was a friendly exercise. I'm telling you, I couldn't do it. I mean, I was back on my computer within 5 or 6 hours, I think. But I could excuse myself that I had professional obligations to meet at the New Yorker magazine and that blah, blah, blah. But I certainly couldn't do it. Anyway, at the end of 48 hours, we totaled up how people did. And of the 32, 11 made it through the 2 days. Of the three... Of the 11, only three read a book. He said, you've got to do something with your time. Don't just sit there staring at the wall. Only three out of the 32 thought, oh, well, I'll fill the time by reading a book. And one said, I had to read a book, as if she were very put upon by this atrocious task. So I got them to write me letters afterwards. What in the world happened? I wrote them individually, and many of them wrote back, and they said things like, I can't do my homework without music. I can't get around the city without music. I can't face the day without music. I can't get through the evening without watching television. I have to know what my friends are thinking and doing, so I'm texting. I want to text, or I want to go on Facebook. You know, it was about need. They needed constant communication, and reading was not part of that. And I mean, so there it is. And this was 4 years ago. I doubt that the situation has gotten any different. If anything, it's gotten worse since then. I mean, let's not misunderstand here. Kids are probably reading more words than ever before, more sheer words. But they're reading, you know, texts, and they're reading on the internet. They're reading parts of articles and parts of novels and parts of things. I mean, they're reading, getting information from everywhere and nowhere. It's a kind of decentered, incoherent intake of information. Whereas when you're reading with a book, you've got an organic form in your lap, and you know it makes you think about yourself as well as the text that you're reading. It's a different kind of experience.
And then he connects this idea of a digital fast and what it did to them, and the students who said, I couldn't do it. You know, 14 students said they did it. He thought a few of them were fibbing. I mean, more than half the class couldn't do it. And he connects it to Brave New World, the tyranny of pleasure, or the tyranny of what they think is pleasure.
Right. Well, Brave New World is a tyranny ruled by sex and drugs. This is Aldous Huxley's mischievous novel. I think he wrote it around 1929, 1930, when new technologies were beginning to open up all sorts of possibilities of control, it's in some ways it's a kind of itchy book because it doesn't sound like the worst place in the world to be. It only becomes clear after a while that the blotting out of freedom and will, which includes the freedom to feel pain, is is crucial. And if you can't fail or feel pain, then you're not free at all. So it's a kind of ironic dystopian fiction.
I just thought the connection of that to the way, you know, maybe the modern soma is Facebook, or now I guess it's Snapchat and Instagram, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden,
quick relief.
You know, all of a sudden the kids start connecting, and you heard students in class say, you know, this idea that they think it's a better world for them. Maybe it's not, because they don't have, you know, individual choices and all these. It was really interesting to hear that lesson and the way it made sense.
Yeah.
Then.
I just, can I just connect this to another book, which is Sherry Turkle. Sherry Turkle is a professor at MIT who was very pro-internet, pro-technology 20 years ago, and has written two devastating books, one called Alone Together, and the other is called Recapturing Conversation, which came out about a year ago. And she did a lot of research with teenagers and discovered that they don't want to make eye contact with each other or with their teachers, that a lot of the time they want to mediate their relationships with smartphones, that they'd rather text. For instance, no one will show up for her office hour. And these are undergraduates and graduate students at MIT. I mean, they're a pretty formidable group. And she happens to be very friendly. I know her. That they'd rather communicate simply by text. And the reason that this concerns her is that she thinks when particularly teenagers confront one another, make eye contact, you know, have that face-to-face thing, that's when you learn, that's when you grow, that's when you have something happens to you. You change, you rise to the occasion, you realize you haven't risen to the occasion, whatever. It's some sort of existential moment, and if everyone's ducking that, it's not good.
Let me get back to the phones. Craig in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Craig.
I'm going to get the book. It sounds fantastic, but you know, you brought back memories of when I was a sophomore, and I did not read anything unless I had to, It was about baseball. But we read Brave New World, we read The Fixer, we read Darkness at Noon, we read Animal Farm, we read Lord of the Flies.
Good serious reading list.
It is, and the teacher got a sort of flack, sort of in class, and even from parents, because they were all downers. But you know what?
Reading list to what Sean Leon was reading. It was treating the kids as if they wanted to be challenged, if they wanted serious texts, if they wanted to face life's darkest issues. I mean, one of the things that he had them read was a concentration camp memoir by Viktor Frankl. I don't happen to like that book, and I think there are better things he could have chosen. But still, it was, you know, what happens to you when you're stripped of your identity and you're just a number, and possibly, likely a corpse. I mean, yes, that is treating 15-year-olds as capable of handling the best. By the end of the year, I wanted some fun, some life. If they could read Shakespeare, I mean, almost any great Shakespeare play would do, but they could read Much Ado About Nothing, which is about sex and connection between men and women. Play, banter, you know, it's a terrific joy. And I wondered what else I could read that would balance the darkness, but that's not, I'm not making up the reading list. That was his choice.
Yeah, if I could just add one thing about Brave New World, I still remember the discussion we had, because my Mr. Shelton seemed like a lot like Mr. Leon, but
right.
I remember I got carried away. I was talking all about what I thought. I think it was Savage, right? That was like what the nickname of the protagonist.
Well, they bring back some of the advanced people, go to the outer territories and bring back someone who's not part of the world society.
Still discussing it as a kid, but it's like, and I totally missed the ending. I got it totally wrong. And the teacher just let me go ahead. He just let me get carried away and talk in the class. And then I think I was, then other classmates sort of set me straight about what really happened in the end. And I was like, oh my God, I missed it totally. But it was so cool. It was so great, because like the teacher wasn't being like prescriptive or anything. He wasn't telling us how to think.
Well, the
about
point
the book.
Was you were excited by the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's what most teachers really want, more than the right answer. You know, it's educational authorities and state funding associations who are putting out money, who are obsessed with test scores. Teachers are often very unwilling to teach to the test. They do it because they have to. You know. So. Fortunately, at a good school like Beacon, they sort of ignore all of that, and they still get their kids into good colleges. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Mary in Rochester, next up with David Denby. Go ahead, Mary. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. Oh, Mary. I've lost you, Mary. You can call back if you like and you want to jump in. It's 844-295-TALK. Got a few minutes left with David Denby, the author of Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. And got an email from a listener named John who wanted to know if the teacher is also helping them not just read but learn to write. And the answer not only is yes, but there was one of my favorite parts of the book because, David, it took me right back to my sophomore year of high school with Mrs. Weatherby. I had a paper I had to hand in on a book, and I felt so good about this paper, and I got a zero on it. And I said, what happened? And she said, the instructions were for you to write the paper, print it out. You know, I'm sure there were instructions on how to title it and all this stuff, and then staple it and hand it in. Mine was not stapled. She said, the staple was on the instructions. You didn't staple it. You get zero. You have to be thorough, and you have to be detailed, and if you fail to understand details, you're going to get killed in this world. And I thought that was so unjust, but I don't feel like I have ever forgotten that.
Right.
And Sean Leon told the story, I think, when he was relaying his college experience.
He misspelled a name. Right. He misspelled Walter Lippmann's name throughout the entire paper.
So he wrote this great paper, gets an F on it, as a way to tell students details matter.
Well, in fact, he did a lot of grammar and a lot of syntax and a lot of writing. I didn't mean to give the impression that he didn't do those things. And he presented it in a kind of up spirit as a kind of reward for the hard work of literary analysis. That would all right, now we'll do grammar for 10 minutes or syntax. And there was a lot of rewriting sentences that had been purposely made askew, and getting the tenses right and the usual kind of 10th grade English. And then for their papers, they went through multiple drafts, and he would read each draft and comment on it. And he would also asked them to, I think it was on the second draft, exchange drafts with their neighbors and ask the other kids to read other people's papers. And they would circle, things that were a bugaboo for him, like excessive use of the verb to be in all its different forms. He wanted them to use active verbs all the time, active. Being is not enough. You have to be doing. It's definitely a vitalist view of existence. So they did a lot of nuts and bolts, meat and potatoes English work.
Let me grab Wayne in Rochester. Go ahead, Wayne.
Hi. I retired a couple of years ago after 37 years of college teaching, which included teaching of literature. And one of the things that I just wanted to point out that I think is very important to realize is that the great works of literature, whether we're talking about a Dostoevsky or Thoreau's Walden or, anything else that has usually survived as a great work of literature, these works were not written with the intention that they would be used and countered by readers who were adolescents or as part of a prescribed, required academic exercise. And this is one of the things that makes it so difficult, in fact, to make many of these works work in the classroom for adolescent Americans, in 2016. It doesn't make it impossible. I mean, the Denby's examples show that, but it's part of what makes it probably unusual that this is so successful, on the occasions when it is. My teaching was mostly done with adult students, actually, adult college students. And I found over the years that many of them were much more capable, much more receptive to their experience of these works than high school students.
All right, Wayne, I got to jump in just because we're going to get tight on time. David Denby, you want to respond to that? Go ahead.
Well, I think you're right, of course, and part of this earlier book that I wrote was reading great works of literature again at 48 and realizing how little I understood of them at 18. But I think, if you're laying the groundwork at 15 or 16 and making a connection with either pleasure or need. I mean, so here were these kids, and we didn't get to discuss the other schools, but here were these kids at Beacon who needed to form their own, tell their own story, so to speak. And Mr. Leon used these texts to provoke that kind of conversation, which, as I said, bordered on confession but didn't quite pass over it, so it always went back to the text. So those kids, even if they didn't get every element of Notes from Underground, and who does, nevertheless got the notion that literature was important to them. And that seemed to me the groundwork for what you're talking about, which is a more mature understanding of books later on in life.
Yeah.
If the connection to need or pleasure is made early, that connection should last.
I will just say to listeners who have listened this hour and can't wait to pick up Lit Up by David Denby, it is great fun to hear some of their remarks. I mean, we barely really scratched the surface on the books, their responses, some of the classroom discussion, and the way it evolves over the course of the academic year. But let me just wrap with this, about 30 seconds, David. This really is the kind of experiment that I want to know what these kids who you met, how many of them become lifelong readers? You know, that's really the test, right?
That's a good, great question, and maybe I should do a follow-up. They're all in college now, that group in Mr. Leon's class, and they generally get into nice places. I think they're all sophomores now, and I would guess about half of them became converts. That's a lot. I mean, because many of them are interested in the sciences, or they're interested in math. I mean, they want to be doctors, they want to be computer technicians. They're not necessarily heading towards the humanities in college. But even so, that doesn't mean they won't become lifelong readers. But you're right, that would be another book to follow up, you know, catch up to people 10 years later.
Well, this is the first book written in the technological age that just looks at whether we can save and preserve the meaning of great literature. And David, thank you for writing the book and for taking the time in the program. I couldn't have enjoyed it more.
Well, thanks. It was wonderful. And thank you for reading it so closely. It means a lot to me.
David Denby, the book is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. Had a great afternoon with you, and we will talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.